Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save
big. Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $38.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, the average Brit gets through 8.5 kilograms of them a year.
In 2019, astronauts on the International Space Station baked some in microgravity.
And in 1975, the BBC used them to pay John Lennon to perform on television.
It's biscuits! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Alex and I'm here with my fellow QI elves, Jack and Manu. Hello both.
Hey.
Hi.
Biscuits, another British classic, another massive topic.
You think?
Well, I think so. I mean, there's so much to debate here. What is a biscuit?
Mm-hmm. Like, this is true.
Maybe we should really start with even just the words. What's a biscuit? What's a cookie?
What's a
scone?
Okay, yeah. Get a sort of scope for the whole thing.
Well, it depends where you are in the world, doesn't it, I think?
A British biscuit mm-hmm. is an American cookie. Mm-hmm. An American cookie is a British cookie.
It's a subsection of biscuits for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then an American biscuit is a British scone.
They're not the same.
But then an American scone is kind of a whole different fruitcakey thing.
Is it?
It's kind of scone-ish, but sort of more cakey.
Is it more like a Welsh cake, the American
I think so,
scone?
Maybe, yeah.
It's kind of like...
Americans, you fucked up, basically. Like, I don't understand. Them. It's one thing to call everything different from another English-speaking nation, but to then pick different words that we already have and just swap them around.
But there's also rusks.
Yeah.
Which are kind of hardened bread things, so they tend to be, like, more savoury.
But aren't they... This is something you probably know, Jack, because your family is South African. Rusks, as I remember, they are very much something that you give to babies and kids because they're this hard thing. They're great for teething. Mm-hmm. Babies, you buy them. They're a baby food in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. In South Africa, they are a snack that people buy and eat as adults.
Because they're all teething and stuff. Gummy.
Their teeth don't come through until they're mid-40s.
I mean, it's just culturally used the same way we'd use biscuits. They're just like, they look like enormous pieces of very hard material. Mm. But the point is you dunk them and then they get soft. And they're kind of like Italian biscotti. Which are just a version of biscuits,
exactly.
I think.
That's true.
I think we expect biscuits to be soft because nowadays it's much quicker to make them softer because you don't have to cook them twice, which is where the name comes from.
Biscoctus.
Biscoctus.
Mm-hmm. Latin for twice cooks.
For two cocks,
And that was to preserve them.
Where
this food comes from. It's a really practical way to store grain and store flour is to dry the shit out of it. And then it lasts on really long journeys. Yeah. And it's durable, so you can like pack it and it will still be intact.
Mm, pre-refrigeration and canning, actually.
Good way to store old food. But one of the things I've found out, which I really liked, was apparently the earliest biscuits, the Sumerians started drying malted barley into rusk. So the same kind of method to store to make beer. So some of the earliest biscuits were used to make beer.
Like a stock cube for beer.
Exactly.
Yeah, just add water.
So cool.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Don't tell hipsters, they'll get so into
on a night out, you should be able to take a dehydrated six pack with you. It'll be
festivals.
Like a fraction, a fraction of the weight.
And then you can just ask for
buy
water.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can even make coasters
but
out of them.
What about...
That's such a great idea.
Yeah.
Stop recording. This is a business we need to write down.
This is now
a livery. This is now an advert for beer.
We need a good funny name. Yeah. Coasters without an E.
Talking about the word cookie.
Yeah.
So apparently that's from the Dutch kookje, which means little cake. Oh. And that word was brought to the US by Dutch immigrants.
Got it.
Well, but that opens up a whole can of worms because of the biscuit versus cake debate, which we'll get into later. Mm-hmm. But if that's what a cookie is, then we're screwed.
Maybe the most famous ingester of cookies, the cookie monster from Sesame Street.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
He actually doesn't eat biscuits.
Huh?
Nor cookies. He eats rice cakes that have been painted because if he ate actual cookies, they don't crumble as well, so they don't look quite so televisual. But they also, the fat would ruin his puppetry.
Oh.
But he's also got
it's like it was a dietary requirement.
No.
The fat
in the chocolate.
Oh.
But yeah, Cookie Monster has a British cousin called Biscuit Monster. He wears a bowler hat and lives in the Furchester Hotel.
Wow.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah,
so in front of us, I thought we would get started with a selection of your classic, your supermarket classics. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with a custard cream.
I haven't had a custard cream in ages.
Can we describe them for international listeners, maybe?
Custard creams are custardy and creamy. What do you want me to say? they are, it's kind of like a square Oreo. A light rectangular Oreo. The inside is kind of custardy flavoury.
Mm-hmm.
They actually go all the way up to Victorian times.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. And the design on them, it's a kind of quite frilly design. It's ferns, because the Victorians were obsessed with fern farms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Everything they designed
fern
was fern.
Because they invented a sort of glass case that could transport ferns around the world. And then they were like, we've got this whole empire. Why don't we just use it for fern collection?
It's actually tacky as hell when you think about it. Like, just put ferns everywhere.
Mm.
Actually, a lot of these famous brands are over 100 years old, which is quite unique amongst foodstuffs.
Well, it reminds me of the chocolate houses.
Yeah.
So it's also a kind of confectionery area.
They're not even as old, but they are quite old. They were sort of invented in the 1930s, like your Mars bar and all this.
Okay.
You've got McVitie's, was founded in 1830. Mm-hmm. Cars in 1831.
Mm-hmm.
Even before that, Huntley and Palmer's, 1822.
Mm. It was, exactly, the Reading-based ones. Mm. There was a whole kind of... It's mm-hmm. similar with Cadbury's and Fry's. Like, only one of them exists today, even though back when they started, they mm-hmm. were both sort of vying for market share. Kind of like the video in Betamax, Zeppelin versus the aeroplane. It was Huntley and Palmer's versus McVitie's, to be honest. And actually, there was a third party, which was called Peak Freens, and they were based in Bermondsey. And their biscuit factory was so big that Bermondsey became known as Biscuit Town. It always
sounds
smelled of biscuits, yeah.
So what do you think the most widely sold biscuit in the world is?
I think is the definitive answer to this.
Is it on this plate?
No, it's not. And actually, the one that I thought was is not on here either. Mm. So until I did my research on this, my guess would have been the Lotus Biscoff. My thinking behind that was it's like a very corporate friendly biscuit, right? Mm. A lot of big companies, hospitality mm-hmm. industries, mm-hmm. a lot of hotels,
mm-hmm.
in particular a lot of airlines, mm-hmm. would buy them in bulk. And it was mm-hmm. the biscuit you find. It's still the biscuit you find in the tea point mm-hmm. at every hotel.
Yep.
And it's given to you on every plane when they give you a biscuit. And apparently that was in the 1990s that they kind of really expanded in the service industry, because they're individually wrapped.
They're vegan as well.
And they're vegan.
Oh, really?
Lotus spread, vegan.
And quite crumb resistant. They don't crumb too much as well. So they're quite clean, mm-hmm. so it's good. So really they're ideal for all of these places.
Mm-hmm.
A tidy, individually wrapped.
But that's not the biscuit you're talking about.
It's not. It's in the top five, I think. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is, Jack?
Well, I think it's the Parl G.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's Parle or Parl, but it's P-A-R-L-E
mm-hmm.
and then hyphen G. The G stands for glucose.
Parl G.
So it's basically only sold in India, but India's got such a big population that they absolutely love it.
It's kind of like that beer in China.
The snow beer, yeah.
But what kind of biscuit is it?
They're like rich teas. So if you can picture, it's quite a plain, but very sort of buttery and sugary, but no sort of frosting or coating or chocolate.
Wait, rich tea is like the round one that is just for dunking.
It looks like a digestive, I guess, but it's a bit softer.
Oh, is that the one that's really plain and it's weird if you eat them and you're not
default,
like 70?
It's like the default biscuit. It's like New Dockland one for biscuits.
No. It's just talking about biscuit history in this country, because sugar came to us quite late in Europe. We missed out for ages across the world. So like in the 7th century, there's evidence of people eating like sweetened stuffed biscuits in Persia called kush kananaj, which is a kind of dried...
Nice work there, Manu. That was a hurdle and you cleared it.
Thank you very much. I shocked myself.
We all just held our breath as she ran her finger under the word and I was like, she's not going to do it.
So it was one of those things where everywhere else, especially in the Middle East, they were enjoying biscuits, and it took us until the 10th century when sugar started kind of slowly dripping its way over.
For biscuits to become sweet and popular.
Before then, we had exactly. We had crackers and like ships biscuits. But yeah, we missed
Everything
we missed
was
out.
Biscuits or porridge. before then.
Yeah.
Nothing tasted nice because there was no sugar, mm-hmm. and everything was either a hard,
really
a hard biscuit.
Hard. But yeah.
Isn't a biscuit just dehydrated porridge? Just add Whoa. Water and milk.
There are two yeah. food groups.
Yeah, forget the cube rule.
There's either dry beer or wet biscuits. That sounds like a boarding school really? Test.
Yeah.
Okay, time for our first lunchbox, and this week that is Jack's.
Hey guys, I've bought you something very boring.
Why, hey guys, you're already here.
I've just arrived,
I like
okay.
it.
So I have brought you something historical.
Mm.
Gird your loins. It's not very nice, but it has basically fueled armies around the world for centuries.
Ooh.
And still doing so. I've brought you some hardtack.
Oh, I've read about
interesting.
This. Where have you found these?
Well, I made these.
You made
oh
these?
Oh my gosh, they look amazing. So what I'm looking at, these pretty hard, flowery solids.
They smell interesting.
And they've got holes in as well. Please don't tell me those are weevil holes.
No, but you've kind of read my mind insofar as the sailors of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, let's say, mm-hmm. they would eat these on board because they're pre-canning, pre-refrigeration, they last for a long time. Because as Manny said, they're desiccated. They're completely dry. Mm-hmm.
What was the recipe?
The recipe was flour, water, heat.
No way.
No, is that it?
There's a little bit of salt. Yeah, I was going to say.
The sailors would have a ration of about 450 grams, 1 pound of biscuits a day, mm-hmm. up until the 18th century, that we have records for at least. And yeah, they'd often be infested with weevils, so you'd have to dunk them in your coffee so that the weevils would float to the top.
And what are weevils?
Weevils are a subsection of beetle, and actually it's a bit of a misnomer because the most common type are biscuit weevils, and more commonly known as drugstore beetles, and they're not true weevils.
What do they look like? I've always imagined there was sort of kind of wormy, maggoty things in this.
Like, well, when they're juveniles, when they're larvae, they are worms.
But I think, are those the same kind of ones you find in like old flour bags and stuff?
Yes, they're the drugstore beetles. Okay. So, yeah.
Your protein.
Extra protein.
But yeah, that's where the sort of idea of tapping your biscuit on the table.
Mm. That's very satisfying.
Get rid of the weevils.
Should we go for it? Should we try it?
So,
it's too hard to break.
So I've read that you're not supposed to eat them like that. You wouldn't have actually eaten them straight as a biscuit.
No.
Because they're way too hard.
That is the hardest. That is too hard.
Yeah, so that's the point, is this is like a preservation technique. This is how to preserve your bread kind of carb. And then you dissolve it in other foods.
So this is just our dehydrated bib at 0%.
Exactly. Okay. The alcohol-free version.
Well, we've done the harder bit first already, because that's always the hard one to crack.
Perfect. But it's one of the dishes that it's so much fun. So there's a famous sailor's dish called lobscouse, and it's actually where the term scouser comes from. So Liverpudlian dock workers used to eat it so much that the name stuck. It's like a kind of meaty, stewy thing, and depending on where you are in the world, you'll put different meats with it. So in the UK, it was usually salt beef, and then for German sailors, it was herring. And in Lapland and colder places, they used walrus meat. But yeah, you'd like crush up your
Like a croissant.
Yeah, but like it would go mushy.
Yeah, of course.
But this is actually one of the weirdest things I've eaten. So I went to Hamburg and we had Lapskaus, and it was like bright pink beetroot meat mush with two kinds of like raw herring. No biscuits in it, but it was
you turned it into fish porridge.
Yeah, more more porridge.
But yeah, I read that the sailors would often crush it into small grind it up and then put hot chocolate over it, and then it basically makes Cocoa Pops, but like, you know, sort of like
that's
a breakfast cereal.
Cool.
Whoa. I mean, that was quite decadent when they had sort of cocoa on board.
So, Cocoa Pops were invented by like 17th century seafarers.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
Wondering if it makes the crackling noise.
But yeah, because they've been used in armies across the world for centuries. There are stories of English soldiers complaining that their Scottish equivalents had fresh oats, and so they were able to make oat cakes. Whereas they were given biscuits, and a lot of sailors would come home, and then they'd find land bread so soft that they couldn't cope with it.
Did you say land bread?
Yeah, as in regular bread that we're all used to.
So that's what I do if I go on like a 2-day
I'll be like, oh, what is this like, land bread?
Oh, land coffee. It's the same. So also the Scots, all of these big burly seamen spend their whole time baking cookies and biscuits. Well, is it like the prison scene in Paddington 2? Where like everyone's like...
I know exactly what you're talking about. You can make these ship's biscuits up to 6 months in advance, and they often would. And they'd make them square or hexagonal so that they stacked easier. And then you just put like so absolute clever. Like crates of them onto a ship. It's just the cheapest, easiest way to create, you know, usable calories.
Yeah. I was going
to
say, I have an image. It's actually really trippy having Jack's biscuit on my notes with a picture of the same biscuit.
Yeah. And it's almost exactly to scale. Yeah, that's so funny. But yours one has of, writing on it.
Exactly, because these are so hard. Sometimes sailors use them as postcards. Yeah. They were that durable. So they'd scratch messages into them and send them. So this one, I've got an image from the National Maritime Museum, and it's one of the oldest surviving biscuits in the world. It's from 1784.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what does it say?
It says...
Wish you were here.
This biscuit was given...
I think it's the name to somebody at Berwick on Tuesday.
13th of April, 1784.
Well, it's quite easy to read. Yeah.
April.
It's kind of like a message in a bottle, I guess. That's amazing.
But biscuits have been very useful for exploration for a very long time. So we're stepping away from the plain ship's biscuit now. But if you fast forward to the 19th century, the late 19th century and the early 20th, there were lots of expeditions to the South Pole. And both Scott and Shackleton actually wrote to Huntley and Palmers to ask for a specific expedition biscuit, which was basically fortified with lots of protein and fats, and because you need to eat so many calories when you're in the cold. But yeah, Shackleton ate these sort of biscuits on Christmas Day, 1902. He wrote in his diary, "Had a hot lunch. I was cook. Bovril, chocolate, and plasmon biscuit. 2 spoonfuls of jam each. Grand."
What? One of the biscuits sold at auction. One of the surviving Shackleton Arctic Expedition biscuits. Yeah.
Do you think someone ate it?
I hope so.
Having paid like £21,000.
It was £1,250.
I'd eat that.
Because another one in 2015, a biscuit sold, was more of a cracker actually, but it sold for £15,000. Can you imagine where that might be from?
Cracker.
The Titanic.
Yes. My first time. Wow. Yeah. Amazing. So this was, it's from the Titanic disaster. So.
Did it float?
Spillers and biscuit, yeah. It was the thing that Rose was on. Yeah. That's how she survived.
The lifeboats are made out of biscuits.
It's from the lifeboat survival kit from the Carpathia. Okay. So it was so a Spillers and Baker's cracker. And it was part of the kind of emergency rations in the Carpathia lifeboat. So one of the survivors, James Fenwick, he was rescued and he kept the biscuit in an envelope marked Pilot Biscuit from Titanic Lifeboat, April 1912.
That is so cool. Yeah. I would eat that as well. I'd eat all of them.
Just back on ship's biscuits, they're still part of German ration kits. These kind of very dry, sort of hard, simple biscuits, basically, without embellishment. And they're known as Panzerplatten, which are basically tank armour plating, as they're so famously hard. And there's lots of rumours and jokes about them. They say they'll block you up so much you don't need to ship for like a week. And they're useful as body armour. If you ever got a tank that's stuck in some mud, you just put 2 Panzerplatten underneath and you can drive it out. And yeah, place 2 packets in the sock and you can beat someone to death with them. It's all just riffs on the same, like they're so fucking hard and dry and they're horrible. I mean, I'm being a bit unfair. Like you say, Manu, this was the sort of base level calories that you could do stuff to.
So they would have crumbled it up and put it in kind of soups. They would have dunked it in hot chocolate. They would have done anything. So this is, it's like an ingredient. I'm really glad that I've actually got to try a proper ship's biscuit.
I know. Super. Thank you, Jack.
I'd like to try one with weevils, though, just so that...
I did think about that. They're quite hard to source.
Why is it called hard tack?
Well,
is it to do with tacking in the ship when you turn and it's called a tack?
I don't think so. It's basically a British Army term for food is tack. Maybe that's where we get tuck shop from.
That's a good shout.
And then the hard bit is because they're not soft.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Time for our second lunchbox, and that is mine.
Ooh.
And I have made you...
My God!
A giant Jaffa cake.
That's amazing.
Should we break into it to show what it is? So the bottom is kind of cakey base, and then it's covered in dark chocolate, and then in the middle is... it's like kind of filled with jelly in the middle.
Mm, orange flavour, hence the name.
So crack it open.
Oh my God. What kind of jelly is that?
Jelly, isn't it?
So I made this, obviously I just wanted an excuse to make a giant Jaffa cake. But also a lot of people probably have heard of the story of Jaffa Cake, McVitie's versus HMRC.
Oh, yes.
Jaffa Cake versus the tax man. This was a taxation debate in 1991. Mm-hmm. McVitie's, the company that make Jaffa Cakes, were challenged by HMRC, who are the people who tax everyone in this country. Mm-hmm. The law states that chocolate-covered biscuits have to be charged VAT because they're a luxury good, so they get taxed about 20%. But chocolate-covered cakes are exempt. They're not luxury goods. HMRC wanted Jaffa Cakes to be classed as a biscuit so they could tax them, and McVitie's said no, they're a cake. But they had to prove in court that it was a cake and not a biscuit, which they did successfully do. But the way that they did it was they baked a giant foot wide Jaffa cake and brought it into court. I wish I could have been there for. I've actually bought some regular Jaffa cakes so that we can compare how big this Jaffa cake is.
Yes.
This one I've made isn't even as big as the one they made in court. Really? I didn't have a 30 centimeter cake tin, which is about a foot, which is one of those big. They gave a load of Jaffa cakes to the judge, and the judge went home over the weekend before he had to give his ruling and really had a long, hard munch and a thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I were the judge, I would have been like, I'm going to need a large supply to make my ruling.
Yeah, yeah.
And the main argument in favor of them being cakes, apart from the fact that they're called Jaffa cakes, is that their base goes hard when they go stale and you leave it out. Basically, biscuits go soft when they go stale, and cakes go hard when they go stale.
Wow.
Because biscuits are baked, they're desiccated, the moisture has gone out when they've been cooked. So when you leave them out, they start absorbing water from the air and they go softer. Whereas cakes, famously, a good cake is very moist and they lose their moisture and it evaporates if you leave it out, so they go hard and crumbly.
So I guess it was only contentious because they are used culturally as biscuits. Mm-hmm. You'll find them on the biscuit aisle. They're biscuit shaped and sized. Mm-hmm. And yet they're called cakes. And like you say, chemically, they're basically small cakes.
Well, this is the thing. And to be honest, part of why I brought it in today was that I want to argue the case that they are biscuits.
What?
Ooh.
I just think culturally, yes, legally, let's call them cakes, whatever you want. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, God, is a hot dog a sandwich for tax reasons. No one really cares. But culturally, I think they're definitely a biscuit. And I am backed up by no less a man than Richard Osman.
Really?
So Richard Osman, for anyone who doesn't know who he is just a sort of British cultural figure in our life.
Wasn't he voted like Weirdest Crush in 2020?
I would say he's like kind of a British cultural commentator. He's a TV producer and TV presenter.
Yeah, his opinion is very much on the pulse.
Yeah, his finger's on the pulse. One of the many fun things he's done online with his big fan base is he's run a series of like World Cups on different things. And in 2017, I think it was for Comic Relief, he ran the World Cup of Biscuits, where he basically ran a series of polls on what was then Twitter and found the voting public's favourite biscuit.
He'd be like Hobnobs versus Ginger Snaps.
Yeah.
And then everyone would vote, and then the winner would eliminate the other.
Oh, I see.
And then there was a kind
you
of, you know,
semi-finals.
And then the final would be between like the two most popular, and then you'd have a winner.
And of course, there were a lot of contentious fights and arguments and debates. But one of them was that he chose to include Jaffa Cakes in the running.
Interesting.
And I'm standing there with him because on every single count, apart from the scientific reason, we use them as biscuits.
Yeah.
We buy them, they're in the biscuit aisle. We buy them, we eat them in the same place and time and in the same way as biscuits. We don't chop them with a knife. So I say they're a biscuit.
I see what you mean. I think what's weird is like what we charge VAT on. Like, why should chocolate-covered cakes not be a luxury, whereas chocolate-covered biscuits are?
Overall winner?
Custard creams.
The chocolate digestive.
Like our favourite biscuit, hands down, many years in a row recently.
It's the one that rocks the boat the least.
That's really nice, Alec. This is definitely one of the more rogue lunch boxes.
Well, Rosie's not here, so
I love it.
Do we go crazy?
Interestingly, HMRC will charge VAT on chocolate-covered gingerbread men, but not if it's used exclusively for the eyes.
Oh, okay, so you can only use chocolate for the eyes?
Yeah, as soon as you put a smile or a little tie or like a cod piece, then it becomes VAT liable.
That's brilliant.
Is it the amount of chocolate or is it just like what's necessary?
No, so you could make enormous eyes.
So
or you could, if you made like a spider and it had loads and loads and loads
eight
of eyes.
Or a horseshoe crab, because they've got like 10 and then yeah,
it's
so
like
many.
Gingerbread horseshoe crab.
This is our second great business idea. The way to get around like tax-free chocolate covered gingerbread man is the loophole everyone's been looking for. This led me into another rabbit hole on biscuit debates. Which is top versus bottom.
Oh,
okay. This was, I promise you, this is about biscuits. I'm talking about hobnobs and I'm talking about chocolate digestives.
Okay. Right? So there's tops and bottoms.
Exactly. Nobs, tops, and bottoms. Exactly. Chocolate? But no, we don't get that. which side is the top side of a chocolate hobnob or chocolate digestive?
Well, surely the chocolatey side's the top, right?
That's if you put them on a plate. I would be disturbed if you served it a chocolate on the bottom.
Yeah, because like, you like hiding something. You might approach
it's
thinking
like,
they're playing and then
see,
put your finger on the bottom.
You served the Jaffa cake chocolate side up. It looks beautiful.
That's true.
I think that those are fair points. So here is the chocolate digestive.
Digestif.
On the one side, you've got pat and chocolate. On the other side,
you've got
the biscuit, but you've got a logo, you've got a design. Mm-hmm. And crucially, McVitie's say that the way that they manufacture these biscuits
is
that they essentially drop it into a river of chocolate, Wonka style, and then those sort of get lifted up on a grid. But at that point, the bottom of the biscuit is the side that's been dunked in the chocolate because the top side has the logo on it.
I guess
right?
In my mind, I imagine them making the digestives and then drizzling the chocolate over the top. But you're right. It's about the manufacturing process. Yeah. If they're dunking them, they're dunking their little toes in.
But the other reason, which I'm surprised you didn't bring up, Manu, because you talked about this with Pringles, is that it makes more sense to eat them chocolate side down because then your tongue is getting the chocolate side.
That is so true.
Yeah.
So anyway, McVitie's say that the chocolate's on the bottom. I'm sure a lot of people would quite aggressively argue that the chocolate's on the top.
Yeah, why didn't you aggressively argue in the comments under this video?
Yeah, why didn't you engage heavily with all of our content? I do think it's a fine display from chocolate, sure, but it does make sense to eat them chocolate down. I think because I'm trying this with a lot of foods now. I'm turning all my chocolate bars upside down to see if I get a different mouthfeel.
Very proud.
I'm trying to put the tastier thing nearer my tongue.
I eat them vertically.
I didn't know that there were multiple kinds of digestive before McVitie's like really, really stole the floor with them. But they were a type of biscuit and not a brand of biscuit.
Oh, yeah.
So they were invented as a literal digestive aid, which is where the name comes from.
Oh, yeah. But didn't the guy who invented them just guess that it was good for you and he had no actual proof?
I think it's to do with they were used with bicarbonate and soda, which people thought was this new wondrous thing that would help ease your digestion, which it is if you eat it in the right way. But once it's baked into a biscuit, it has no effect, really.
Yeah. So the early versions were made with like caraway, which was meant to help colic. And then they started using sweet meal flour, which was slightly fermented. And at the time, in the 18th century, they thought that slightly fermented foods were supposed to help digestion because they were kind of like pre-digested through the fermentation. And then, yeah, like you said, they added baking powder, which was supposed to be even better. And one of the reasons why McVitie's did so well is because they put sweet meal flour and baking powder together and everyone was like, whoa, this is going to be the best digestive aid in the world. And then they added chocolate and now we are obsessed with them.
Do you know PG Tips, the tea brand?
Yeah.
Pre-gestive. That's what the PG stands for.
Oh,
what?
That's a good fact. Why didn't you mention that in the tea episode?
Yeah. True. You can just slot that in.
PG tips. So you're drinking a PG tips and a digestive.
And you shit yourself.
Which is very different to what the French call a digestif, which is just a little like shot of pastis or something very alcoholic that you have after your meal.
Too many words for different drinks at different times the French have.
Do you know what the French slogan for digestive biscuits is?
Oh, no, I do. But I can't remember. But I know it's funny.
Nice.
Well, why don't you tell us?
It's c'est anglais, mais c'est bon. It's English, but it's good. This is great.
That's such a backhanded compliment.
Yeah.
I just
it's also not English, it's Scottish.
Yeah, that's so true. They invented in Scotland. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Cool. In 2005, McVitie's, actually speaking of McVitie's, I don't know how much of a PR stunt this was, but they developed a crumb test dummy, so-called, which was, there is a picture of it. It's a mannequin with a chewing movable mouth that was designed to replicate human eating. And they said that they had to...
No, I don't like it. I'm already imagining it. I'm scared.
Gross. It's pretty gross. And it's just for designed for like chewing biscuits so they can get the exact right amount of
chewability. Did they use chocolate for the eye, isn't it?
It was tax-free. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Okay, so moving on to another big debate around biscuits that digestives are a big part of, dunking.
I never do it.
Mm-mm. You never do it. You never dunk. You don't dunk?
I'm not a dunk.
And what is it to foreigners?
It's dipping your biscuit in your tea.
Listen up, foreigners.
But the key is you want to dunk it as much as possible to get a lot of flavour, to melt the biscuit, to get your biscuity flavoured tea, to get your nice melted, soggy, chewy biscuit, but you don't want to put it in there too much because it's going to disintegrate and fall in, and then you've got half a biscuit in your tea, and then you might as well kill yourself.
It
ruins everything. Best biscuit for dunking?
Oh, a Tim Tam. Ooh. Is the only biscuit I know of that gets better when it's dunked, and it's kind of shit when it's not been dunked.
Tim Tam being an Australian penguin.
Yeah. So the classic way they eat them is they bite the ends off either side and then they use it as a straw.
Oh, I've done that with Kit Kat.
And then you suck up the liquid. And because it's quite a dry biscuit, it's really nice when it gets all like malty and tea.
Let's try that. In 1999, there was a British scientist called Dr. Len Fisher.
Okay.
He won the Ig Nobel Prize, which we've mentioned before. It's a kind of Nobel Prize alternative that gives awards to very legitimate research, but quite alternative odd research. So he won an Ig Nobel Prize in 1999 for researching the optimal way to dunk a biscuit.
Right.
Yeah. So he used capillary flow equations, and he found that a quick dunk of around 3 to 5 seconds, if you use the kind of typical biscuit, is the best amount of time for soaking up the most flavour. Any longer than 5 seconds, you are serious risk of losing half a biscuit. Then I also found the highest biscuit dunk ever. World record four.
Really long biscuit?
No, this is what I thought it was. No, it's from a height. So.
Oh, I think I've seen this footage.
Have you?
Yeah. It's amazing. It's the most British thing ever. I think I saw it where they like paused it after the dunk and then just played the national anthem.
2016, a guy called Simon Berry bungee jumped from a crane with a chocolate digestive in his hand and dunked it into a cup of tea on the floor. 73.5 metres was the dunk.
I hope he ate it on the way out.
I was going to say, imagine if you dropped it right at the last second.
I'd have saluted him if I was there.
I'm behind that dunk. Love it. One of my favourite biscuit facts is the rumour that a digestive biscuit broke up the Beatles.
Oh my God, I heard this. This is so good.
Stupidest story. When Yoko Ono moved into the Abbey Road studio.
Yoko Ono being John Lennon's wife.
Exactly. Yeah. She like properly moved in her bed and everything.
Wow.
She stole a biscuit from George Harrison's biscuit tin, and he got so pissed off at her, he called her a bitch. And that was like the last straw.
Okay, on to our third and final lunchbox, which this week is Manu.
Today I have brought a heart-shaped cookie cutter.
Oh, classic.
This one is not your classic. This is an anatomically correct...
That's amazing.
3D printed cookie cutter. It's so cool. The sharpest bit is the outline that runs along the outside. And then there's a shallower compression where you've got all of the like
chambers.
So when you press it down, it's got all of this incredible detail on top and then the crazy heart shape around the outside.
Not as romantic as the classic heart-shaped cookie.
I don't know. I like it. It's realism. It's raw. It's love is disgusting.
Your reason of being broken up with.
No. What I love about this cookie cutter is actually quite close to the origins of these beautiful, elaborately molded biscuits. So there's a historian called Sharon Hudgens who edited the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. And she...
So like, great, great work, Oxford, Oxford Publishing. What is that? I mean, you've done the dictionary, you've done the thesaurus, and then you've done Companion to Sugar and Sweets.
Yeah, they're smashing it. But it's also, Jack, don't you use the Oxford...
Companion to Food, Amadeus, and every week. If you want any spoilers... for any future episodes. It's just also read the whole of that book. Massive. It's an incredible time.
But she says the picture cookies, as we know them, come from Yule Fest, like the Germanic pagan festival in winter. And that festival traditionally involved a lot of animal sacrifice. But she said that if you were poorer and you couldn't afford to kill your animals at the festival, you could make animal replicas out of biscuits and offer those instead. So the dough effigies were a way more affordable way to take part in the festival.
And vegan. Legit vegan, because you're literally saving an animal. Biscuit,
yeah. In fact, it's sort of vegan negative in the way that carbon negative is like giving back.
Yeah. Love it. So yeah, and then these dough effigies have been found in archaeological digs. So people would have eaten them at these festivals. But this kind of tradition of elaborate biscuits survived in Germany. And in the 16th century, like loads of different kinds of molds are being developed. Mm. Some made of metal, some made of wood, some more expensive ones made of ceramics. And then in the 19th century, like post-industrialization, the mass production of metal cookie cutters meant that like basically anyone could do it. Mm-hmm. And you get even more crazy shapes. That's when like the heart-shaped cookie becomes really popular. But
and also the advent of penis pasta, of course.
Oh, yes. Exactly.
A groundbreaking development in food molding.
This is every time we record here.
Yeah, that is the only food in this kitchen that we borrow to record here. Is there is a packet of dried penis pasta we have to move out of shot every day.
We should cook it. We'll ask you if we can cook it one day. But there is one kind of traditional, like less mass-produced mold that survived even after this era, which was the funeral cookie cutter. So these were stamps that were made out of wood. And in Victorian England in particular, there was a really big culture of giving out biscuits to kind of tell people that a funeral was about to happen. So they'd make hundreds of these things, depending on how big a funeral was. And it was all given out in this process called bidding. There's nothing to do with auctioning. It was more like a kind of...
I bid you to come to the funeral.
Exactly. Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Yes. So you'd make your special biscuit, and you'd stamp it with a special funeral wooden stamp. And then you'd wrap it in these like biblical verses. And then you'd have someone, a bidder, go to people's houses and deliver these funeral biscuits. And it's like, you have been invited to this person's funeral, blah, blah, blah. Information's on the thing. In my head, it's kind of like a party bag. But before the party, and the party is a funeral.
I guess it softens the blow, right? Like you open the door and you're like, oh no, Greg's died. Ooh, I love that. We should do that more.
Edible invitations.
Edible invitations.
What would your food be? Because mine wouldn't be
spaghetti.
Biscuits.
I just draw a message in spaghetti.
Aww.
Or you can have a really long spaghetti that you just follow to the funeral.
Yes,
like a map. You can have the details of the funeral in alphabet spaghetti. Aww. And then one long strand of tagliatelle to take you all the way there.
What would your funeral food be, Alex?
How about a lasagna? Because everyone needs a lasagna when they're grieving. Yeah. Everyone gets a free lasagna.
That's quite sweet. So is this anything to do with the tradition of sin eaters?
No, what's a sin eater?
Sin eater, I think it was a bit before the Victorian period, but you'd basically pay someone who's quite destitute to come and eat a biscuit that was placed on the coffin of the deceased, and the biscuit was supposed to absorb all the sins.
Ooh.
As it got stale.
And sins. Yeah. Nice.
And then you pay someone who was like on the edges of society to eat the biscuit and then absorb all the sins.
Oh my god!
Because they were going to hell anyway, because they were vagrants.
Poor people cannot catch a break.
They were paid to eat biscuits.
I think that was actually a great deal if you're an atheist.
Should
we finish off with biscuit tins?
So the first biscuit tins were made by one of those companies that I'd never heard of. Exactly. It was one of those things where kind of serendipitously the son of Joseph Huntley had an ironmongery across the road from the biscuit factory at the time, the biggest biscuit factory in the world. And when they were trying to figure out a good way to ship their biscuits long distances, they were like, hold on a second.
The guy over the road.
Yeah.
There's that internet trope of going to your grandma's house and opening the biscuit tin and it's a sewing kit.
Yeah. So sad. And there is one particular Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin that's still in use and has a very important and prestigious use.
Oh, yeah.
It's the biscuit tin of democracy. And this is in the New Zealand Parliament.
Okay.
So they have a system where members' bills, so that's the ones that individual members can put forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's lots of them. And before 1990, the order in which they were debated could be chosen via, like, influenced by political deals, and it wasn't kind of very fair. And so in 1990, the Clerk of the House, who's a guy called David McGee, he decided to introduce a lottery system to make the process fairer. So all of the members' bills that were up for being debated, they would pick one at random.
Right.
So they decided to do this with a series, like a little lottery, a series of like sort of small balls with numbers in. And they needed something to put all those balls in. So they grabbed the first convenient thing they could find, which was a Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin in the office kitchen.
Nice.
And now, like, more than 30 years later, they still use it. And you can see it on TV. And it is a Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin with a kind of rubbish label, like handwritten, this is members' bills on it, kind of sellotaped on. I love that it's like a really young tradition that's
so
clearly going to
good.
Last for a long, long time. But again, that's the ultimate disappointment. To sneak into the government and be like, oh, I got all the biscuits.
Package.
They're just the next biscuits. 20 years of legislation.
Yeah. So good.
All right, that is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
Yes, that's right. And you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions, feedback, abuse by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Onryo, and produced by me, Alex Bell. It was mixed by Li Ying Li. This has been a quite interesting podcast.